25% of our annual budget comes from listeners like you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting CKUW 95.9 FM at Fundrive.
This is Olivia. You're listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screening media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we will be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. And just to remind everybody, CKUW's Fund Drive starts on Friday, February 5th. If you can, please consider pledging for the benefit of your community radio station, which operates around the clock every day of the year, bringing you content, community-focused content. Listener support is a crucial part of our budget, and your dollars keep us growing. Visit fundrive.ckuw.ca to donate. Today, I'm joined again by Allison Lang. Thanks so much for being on the show again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison is a writer and editor based in Toronto. She writes for Rue Morgue and wrote a book called Women with Guts in the Rue Morgue Library. She also makes zines and is currently working on part two of her Music Men Ruined For Me series. Along with Esther Splett, she co-hosts a bi-monthly Facebook movie series called Toxic Femmes Films, focusing on movies about hags, harpies, lesbians, sluts, and monstrous women.
Yes, so we have an event coming up, and it's very exciting because it's our first event of 2020.
And 2021.
Yes, 2020 is over. Big fuck. 2020.
We're in a time is meaningless. It's fine.
Flat circle.
Yeah.
This is a very exciting event because none other than Olivia Norquay, who has curated a screening for us before as well. She is curating this particular screening, and the main feature we're showing is Cherry Falls, which is the late 90s, early 2000s slasher starring Brittany Murphy. It's kind of like an inversion of a lot of slasher tropes, mm-hmm. where, like, I don't think this is a spoiler, but the killer targets virgins instead of people who are wantonly having sex, wanton teens. So all the characters have to, like, sort of deal with that, and it's a really weird, funny movie.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing choice, especially for Valentine's Day. It just kind of feels like the perfect Valentine's Day slasher. And then Olivia's also programmed, I should just say you've programmed.
Yeah.
She's programmed an amazing pre-show full of, like, super awesome stuff. I don't want to spoil, but yeah.
surprise shorts.
Yeah, lots of sweet surprise shorts. And that will be happening on Saturday, February 13th. To get the details, it will be at 8:30 p.m., but you should join the Toxic Femmes group on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And that is where all the info will be posted, including the watch party link. We will be hosting it on a platform called CozMe, which is really easy to use, and fingers crossed will be minimally glitchy. But yeah, it should be good. And we can all... there's a chat function so we can all chat and, like, you know, make fun of the movie and
yeah, it'll be so great. I'm so excited. Thanks so much for inviting me to program that.
Yeah, of course.
All right. And today we're wrapping up Anthology Month with the 2017 horror anthology film XX.
What's in the box?
Present.
Can I see?
Danny.
Stop being so nosy.
It's okay.
I don't think anyone's been up here in a really long time.
Maybe it's cursed.
Your son tore my daughter's fingernails off.
You're not going to punish him?
Listen, you gotta eat something. It's been 3 days, buddy.
Not hungry.
Something's happening to Andy. Something just terrible.
You're not getting up from this table until you eat that pizza. Do you understand me? Just eat!
If you don't eat, eventually you'll die.
So?
Oh,
In the first ever all-female horror anthology, filmmakers Jovanka Vukovic, Annie Clark, Roxanne Benjamin, and Karen Kusama present four horrific tales of terror. The anthology is framed by a stop-motion animated segments depicting a walking dollhouse with a blinking doll face on it. A separate doll hand that's also living moves from its drawer and scurries around collecting these creepy little items. In the first segment, the box, a boy, Danny, starts to display strange behavior after looking inside a mysterious gift box. From that day on, Danny simply stops eating without any reason, except, as he says, there seems to be no point. His self-starvation is contagious as his sister and father also stop eating. In The Birthday Party, Mary is attempting to hold a birthday party for her daughter Lucy, but when she finds her husband David dead in his home office, she decides to hide the body instead of calling 911. She spends the day frantically trying to conceal David's body from Lucy, nanny Carla, and neighbor Madeline. She finally buys a panda costume off a man who comes to sing Lucy's birthday song and hides the body in the costume. During the party, Mary does not have time to move the costume body and is forced to set it up at a seat at the table. Carla bumps the costume, causing it to collapse into Lucy's birthday cake. The body is then discovered when Carla, attempting to lift up the panda, accidentally removes the head, and the full title of the film is revealed as a children's scream in terror. The Birthday Party, or the memory Lucy suppressed from her seventh birthday that wasn't really her mom's fault, even though her therapist says it's probably why she fears intimacy. In Don't Fall, four friends, Paul, Gretchen, Jess, and Jay, are all on expedition out in the desert. The four discover an ancient cave painting depicting an evil spirit before camping out for the night. Gretchen is then attacked by a creature similar to the spirit in the painting, which takes over her body and wears her skin. It kills Paul and Jay before chasing Jess, who then falls and breaks her leg. The Gretchen creature then descends the cliff to kill Jess. In the last short, her only living son, it's also about a mother, Cora, and her son, Andy, on the eve of his 18th birthday. His father is absent and surrounded in some mystery, as are, it turns out, many of the locals with whom Cora interacts. Despite her son having apparently pulled the fingernails off of one of his classmates and killed a squirrel and just generally being an asshole, the principal and the teachers refuse to expel or even suspend him. Cora becomes increasingly anxious about the changes her son is undergoing. Andy, whose voice has changed and finger and toenails have become claws, confirms her suspicions. He's transforming into the spawn of Satan. So yeah, Allison, what is your history with XX?
It's been a few years now, but I remember when sort of the teaser posters for XX started coming out and appearing on sites like Bloody Disgusting and whatever. Mm-hmm. I got really excited because I like anthology films a lot, but this seemed very historic and exciting, like one that's completely directed by women. And then when I found out who was involved, I got even more excited because a lot of us, I assume, I like love Annie Clark and like mm-hmm. I'm low-key obsessed with her. Jovanka, it's funny, when I read Rumorga as a young person, or a younger person, Jovanka was the editor when I started reading Rumorga, and she,
oh, wow.
Yeah, she was super, larger than life, just like she's very tall and has like crazy vibrant hair and tons of tattoos, and I know that's all very superficial, but she just comes across as very like self-possessed. A woman editing a horror magazine was kind of like, you know, as someone who grew up reading horror magazines that were really male managed and edited by men, and the fan community were largely comprised of men, mm-hmm. kind of getting into those scenes, she was revelatory to me. And in fact, when I my first year of university, I was like 19. I wrote her an email and I was like, do you like need any writers for the magazine? Like maybe I could write some, like I didn't even have a pitch. I was just like, maybe I could do something.
Yeah.
And she wrote me back the same day, which if you know, like editors of anything, they don't usually do that. Like usually folks are pretty busy, and I imagine she was very busy, but she was like, Allison, that rules. I want more women writers in the magazine. We don't need any new writers right now, but like please keep in touch with us. So I did. I would like email her. I emailed her again like a couple of years later. I was like, do you need it? And then I started writing for the magazine, like sort of in the literary section with Monica Kugler, who still works in that section of the magazine. But yeah, anyway, long rambling story. So I was really excited to see this coming out. And then I actually saw the Toronto, I guess, sort of premiere. It was not like a fancy premiere. I think it was just like the screening in Toronto. Mm-hmm. But Jovanka was there, and I went with Andrea Suvasati and Alex West, who co-host the Faculty of Horror podcast. Mm-hmm. And then we were all quite excited for the anthology. And then we like went up and talked to her afterwards, and she was incredibly lovely and gracious and not intimidating at all. And I was like really intimidated, mm-hmm. but she was super lovely. So I have like really nice thoughts and feelings about this film and nice associations because, you know, it's not a perfect movie. And I, you've talked about this whole month, like anthology films are super messy and uneven, and it's really hard to have a consistent, you know, it's hard to maintain a consistent quality in all of the shorts. And that's true for, I think, anything like this. But yeah, I really admire what she did. And I admire all the filmmakers for, you know, getting a chance to tell these stories in this framework. So my feelings about the movie are, yeah, overall, like just very positive associations.
That's such a great story. That's so nice.
It's a rare nice thing when you meet someone who's like kind of a hero and they're like very, very nice.
That's so great. Yeah, this is my first time seeing XX, so thanks so much for suggesting it. And yeah, like I think it's like really cool and important that this is an anthology directed entirely by women. And I have a habit, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, of just watching a lot of films by cis white men, especially in the horror genre. So this is, yeah, it's just really cool to see this anthology, and I hope to see more projects like it. In doing my research for the show, I came across this 2018 interview from The Polygon with Jason Blum by Matt Patches. So I have a quote here. Blumhouse Productions has been in the scare business since 2006. 2006's Paranormal Activity, and in that time, despite dozens of movies behind it, the company has not produced a theatrically distributed horror film directed by a woman. With more and more female voices emerging through the festival circuit, from which many of Blumhouse's directors emerge, the omission struck me as odd and compelling. When I asked Blum about hiring a woman to direct one of the company's horror films, he too seemed jolted by the idea that it hasn't. We're always trying to do that, he says. We're not trying to do it because of recent events. We've always been trying. There are not a lot of female directors, period, and even less who are inclined to do horror, Blum says. And that's such a frustrating quote, but at the same time, like, I have this habit too of only watching movies even covering films by like cis white guys, and it's, I don't know, I guess it's just out of laziness or like what films are being picked up or promoted to us or anything like that. But yeah, what do you think about that quote?
I remember when that quote came out and when the interview came out, and it, you know, rightfully caused quite a stir. Like I remember a lot of pretty much all the people that I follow on social media who are involved in horror in any way has sounded off about that, especially tons and tons of women and a lot of male allies. And you know, I remember seeing threads and threads on Facebook and Twitter that were like, there's not a lot of female horror directors, what about so-and-so, 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 like just like naming people. You know, Jovanka was named, the Soska sisters, who I am not a fan of, but they were named a number of times. There were quite a few other people. You know, I'm sure Jason Blum got really bombarded with that information. And then I have noticed since then that like, there have been more female directed movies kind of coming from that, from Blumhouse. I'm kind of blanking on all of them right now, but the most recent, like the most notable one that I can remember is Black Christmas, the remake. That was directed, it was written by April Wolf, and the director, I'm blanking on it right now, but I just saw another movie by her, so I'm just like, Sophie Takal, who is an up-and-comer, you know, like a director in not just horror, but like everywhere, and an actress as well. And kind of like a figure who's kind of coming up right now. But yeah, the thing I struggled with that particular film was that it was announced like in August or the summer, and then it was coming out in December of that year. So it really feels like, and I know this hasn't been the case with all of the Blumhouse films directed by women, but it feels like they're like, yeah, we got a woman writer, woman director, let's fucking slap it on, let's just push it out there, come on, gotta do it. And they're not like giving the you know, the runway necessarily, at least publicity wise. Like it, yeah, and it was sort of distressing to me, feeling like these women are not being given a fair shake, because they're asked to, like, first of all, helm a remake of like a really beloved property, and then also you're like, are you rushing it out? You're like churning it out, and you're not getting enough time to, like, you know. And it's not to say that people can't make movies quickly, or that, like, you know, God, women can't make movies quickly. That's the opposite. You know, like, think about when we talked about Ravenous and how Antonia Bird basically saved that whole production and cranked that movie out in like
a week or something.
So yeah, like, they can get the job done, but like, yeah, it's definitely, you want to make sure that it's, and I think it's, this is true with any type of like tokenism where you're using someone who represents a particular community to present work and be ostensibly part of the new face of your company, you know, as all of his films are. Like, I think you have to give, you have to ensure that they're given the tools to succeed the same way men are just given. Men are just like given films, especially before. They're just like, oh, you made this, like Adam Wingard is such a huge example of that. Like, they're like, oh, yes, like, okay, here's like fucking Blair Witch go, like, yeah.
Or you made Pineapple Express. Here's Halloween.
Here's Halloween. Are you a horror director? No, not really. But you'll be fine.
You're a guy. You got it. You're fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's just stuff like that. It grinds my gears. But I do feel like, sorry, this has become a rant. But
I love it. Please.
I feel like he heard. Like, I don't think, like, Jason Blum is a bad guy. I think he's a typical horror guy in that he's like, what do you mean?
There's a bit of a dum-dum.
Yeah, he's kind of a dum-dum. He's, like, not very aware. And he's just like, well, because his experience, there just weren't a lot of horror women around. So
girls don't even like movies.
They don't like movies. They don't like horror movies. They're scared. They don't like horror. And it's just like, it just, like, go anywhere. Go to any festival. Like, look. Anyway, so it seems like that I'm glad that interview happened, because that is a larger conversation.
Totally. But yeah, but like you said, with the filmmakers of the Black Christmas remake, there is that pressure. And then if that movie doesn't do well, then
why did we give those two?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, it failed because these two women made it. Irritating.
Yeah. It's also annoying.
So yeah, back to XX. Do you have a favorite segment?
I do, and it's probably unsurprising, but it is Annie Clark's The Party. I we'll talk more about that. And I've heard like, you know, both sides on that segment. Like, I know some people who like it, and I know some people who are like, But yeah, I do like when people who you don't associate with like horror things take a dip into what they think horror is, like what a horror short would be. And I just like the idea of St. Vincent being like, oh, I've been asked to direct a short in a horror movie. What means horror to me? Well, there's this giant bear. And everything's candy colored, and there's a lot of anxious women running around, and there's a lot of secret unspoken things. Yeah, and it's just a little, it's kind of weird, and it's really awkward in its own. Yeah, there's just a lot of things about it that I really like. So that's my fave, I think. What about you?
Yeah, I'd say The Birthday Party and Her Only Living Son. The Birthday Party, because it is like, it's silly but stressful and like sinister in a way. Like, whenever Carla, the nanny, would come in, there would be like a music spike, even though she's not doing anything. She's just like, kind of has a weird haircut and but is given like this sinister edit. I just really like it. It's very funny. And then, yeah, her only living son, and we'll get into it a little bit later. But yeah, I thought that was like an interesting idea. I have thoughts about it though. And then, but yeah, we'll get into it more. So just in case you haven't been listening this month, an anthology film is a subgenre of films consisting of several different short films, often tied together by only a single theme, premise, or brief interlocking event. The past few weeks, we've covered the 1964 Japanese folk anthology, Koidan, the very bro-y VHS from 2012, and the comic book style film Creepshow from 1982, and the dreamlike anthology Three Extremes from 2004. And before this month, I hadn't really seen a lot of horror anthologies, like mostly like Creepshow and Twilight Zone movie, but it is interesting to see the sort of like differences in storytelling when it's just one director working on a collection of short films versus like a bunch of directors working on it. It is interesting to see like what different directors can bring to the medium and the sort of storytelling style. So I have a quote here from Don Keatley from horrorhomeroom.com talking about XX. Since the quality of the films and anthologies are typically uneven, I was pleasantly surprised by the high quality of all four of the short films in XX. They're all well-directed, well-written, well-acted, and all four of them offer something, some enigma to think about after the film ends. In fact, that's how I'd sum up what ties the films together, which is perhaps indicated in the title. Each film introduces a mystery that remains a mystery, a kind of gap or hole in the story that doesn't get filled in. X, as it were, marks a spot. X marks the central and provocative absence, which is such an interesting take. Like, nothing is really resolved. The mysteries aren't solved. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah, that never would have occurred to me when thinking about the title of the film. And I think it's very appropriate.
Yeah. And are you a fan of anthologies usually, like anthology films or books or anything like that?
I am. I don't know why, because, you know, like as we've said before, like they're uneven and like, you know, you got some, I find every anthology film has one segment that you're just like, ooh.
Yeah.
It's just not, it just kind of is less good. But that being said, I do like them. And I think it's just, I guess if you're watching kind of a mediocre horror film, you're kind of stuck for an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas with an anthology, it's so easy to pivot to the next story.
Mm-hmm.
I like, there's something new. I have to say, I love the ABCs of Death films 1 and 2, because there's so many little shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so like, I don't know if you, like, I don't know if that's more an assemblage of shorts than an anthology, but yeah, I like short films too in general. So an anthology is pleasing to me, because I like when directors tackle the challenge of like, yeah, telling a shorter story with their particular aesthetic.
Yeah, totally agree. So shall we go over each short and talk about the movie?
Yeah.
A little bit more? Okay. What did you think of the first segment, the box?
I'm looking at your notes and then I'm looking at my notes and seeing kind of where we jive. And yeah, it's funny because the first time I watched it in the theater, I have to say I think because when there's narratives involving like issues with food, especially in horror, I, like a lot of people, have, you know, I've dealt with like body dysmorphia and eating disorders in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of narratives, they hit me really hard and they're very distracting. Like I like to see them. I like that those issues are explored, but they're overwhelming. And it, for the box, it was hard for me to focus
on wow.
Like a lot of other stuff that was going on, because I was really anxious. That people not eating, it made me really anxious. Like the story made me like, but then watching it the second time, the motherhood stuff came up way more.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, like, I just noticed, like, the little things, and this must have been deliberate, but, like, every time they're sitting at the table, and it starts out with these beautiful meals, like, almost like a Thanksgiving meal on a weekend. And I'm like, how the fuck is this mom making this meal? Like, she's obviously working as well. She's, like, two goddamn kids and this husband who's, like, very bossy, to be honest. And, but she makes this gorgeous meal, and, you know, as the movie progresses, the meals become less elaborate. They sort of take out more junk food and less, like, effort. I'm also presuming she's putting in the all the effort on the meals, which I think is very a gendered assumption. It could very well be the husband who's doing all of these meals. But yeah, I find it so interesting that the husband is the one expressing so much concern and, like, kind of fussing over the children. And she's kind of just like there's literally shots of her being like,
like, yeah, like shrugging and eating.
And I really liked that a lot. I don't know, I'm not sure what the final takeaway from it all was, but I definitely got the sense that, like, she just, like, it's the whole box is a metaphor that she, like, doesn't fit in with her family. Really resisting. You've made the very good note here, like, the being consumed by family when she's physically consumed. Like, I think she's very resistant to that until the end, at least. But yeah, it was funny how, yeah, that jumped. And I don't know if it's, like, being a couple years older too, but that narrative came up very strongly for me.
Yeah, I thought, because there's one shot where essentially she's the meal and her, like, it's very gory and, like, it looks very cool, where her husband is cutting into her leg and serving her flesh to her children. And then they're finally eating and then she's smiling. I just thought, yeah, like, what a, like, dark, horrible image. And yeah, it just, like, really, really stuck with me. But yeah, it's interesting to see her sort of, like, how she continues to eat while her family's sort of withering away. And then she also, like, starts smoking. So these, like, little parts of her identity are coming, or I'm assuming, like, coming back. Like, she grabs, like, a hidden pack of smokes and, like, can have, I don't know. I just found that, like, yeah, like, this idea of, like, being consumed by her family, but then also, like, giving up her identity to become a wife and mother. Really cool. I also read, I'm not sure if this was intentional or how you think about this, but so she's there when she's with her kids on the train. There's a man on the train there with a big red gift box. And I saw that as, like, he saw that she was tired and frustrated and, like, taking the train back to the suburbs, and, like, almost he took her family away as a gift to her.
I totally see that. Yeah, because she's, like, yeah, she's very annoyed in the beginning scene. She looks very tired. The kids are like, rah, rah. And she's, like, being nice, but she's also sort of like, yeah, it's fair. And then, yeah, that kind of lines up with the end too, where she's like, she wants to see the gift. She wants the gift, but she can't have it.
Because,
that's not how it works. That's not how it was intended to be received. Her family has to be completely enfolded in that. I would say that is a good interpretation.
And actually, yeah, the theme of, like, boxes and gifts comes up in two shorts. So I have another quote from horrorhomeroom.com. Boxes evoke the unknown. They conceal and contain both wondrous and horrible things. And in many films, boxes hold a component of weighty choice, a path not taken or a rule broken. Each container holds a picture of what we reveal, what we hide, and who we are. What did you think of the birthday party? You kind of talked about it a little bit, but we can go into a little bit more detail.
Yeah, I really liked it. I thought it had, for a first-time filmmaker also, I thought Andy Clark had a really great understanding of the tone she wanted to bring forward. Just very dark comedy, but as you said, she also has a firm grip of melodrama, like, kind of hilarious melodrama, like it was funny when I was watching this time too. The music cues are very over the top. The music is very, like, as you would expect with I guess, any movie that Annie Clark would make, the music is really at the forefront of the story. But yeah, it seems like she had a very firm command of like the sensibility she wanted to bring forward. I did just like, my takeaway is just like, she's horrified and sad that David has killed himself, but she's also so annoyed at him.
Like, yeah.
Well, why the fuck do you get to kill yourself?
Yeah.
Goddamn party and deal with my weird housekeeper and like my child and this thing I don't want to do. And it's funny how also in dealing with David, it kind of like gives her an excuse. She doesn't have to get all dolled up.
Mm-hmm.
When all the kids come, she's still in her like nightie and like, her dressing gown. She doesn't really have to put on any airs. She doesn't have to be like nice to the neighbors or like, you know, when her neighbor, one neighbor like invites herself over, she's like, yeah, like whenever you want. Like,
yeah.
It kind of like removes David's suicide kind of gives her the freedom of like not needing any social niceties anymore. Mm. And then the ending, like how it's so, you know, it's in slow motion and so surreal when David and the bear kind of like topples over, even her reaction is kind of like, oh geez.
Yeah. Like, and she's like, no.
Yeah, and it's not, she's not horrified, she's just, she's so like burnt out or whatever that she's like,
totally.
Oh, well,
yeah, she's more like embarrassed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very funny. Like, it's really enjoyable. And I do think it's like undeniably very feminist. Like, the ideas that it's advancing are very like, yeah, it just feels like, and yeah, and I got a weird sense too. I don't know if you read this too, but like when with her housekeeper too, there's almost like a bit, there's sort of sexual tension. There's like sexual tension, but also hatred.
Yeah.
And I can't quite figure the housekeeper out. Like, she is the one cipher in this story where I'm like, I don't know. Was she having an affair with David?
That's how I read it.
Yeah.
Or yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. I think like it's very up to interpretation. She just gets like a sinister edit and a sinister like music spike.
Yeah, and sinister hair.
Sinister hair. Very funny.
She looked familiar to me, so I looked her up, and she's actually played by Sheila Vand,
who
was the girl in The Girl Walks Home at Night. Mm-hmm. So that is why. I was like, she looks very familiar. But yeah, anyway.
I watched The Rental the other day, and she was in that too.
Was she?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that yet.
It's okay. You should watch it and then let me know how you think, how you feel about it. The birthday party also deals with like motherhood and suburban anxieties and like the pressure to like be a perfect mother and wife and neighbor and kind of like maintain this like very 1950s like domestic life, like especially in like the colors and the family dynamic I found. And I don't know, this segment really stressed me out. Like, I think just trying to watch her like cover up, not even a crime, like she just can't ask for help because then she'll be seen as a failure, I feel. So that kind of, I don't know, just ask for help. It really stressed me out.
It's true. And you can tell she's very used to that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or maybe she and her housekeeper are used to kind of covering up for David's whatever. Like, where is it when she first discovers his body, or maybe right after? And she says, or maybe it's right before, she's like, oh, I don't think Dad's going to make the party today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sort of implying that, you know, he's like absent. Mm-hmm. Like, busy working, so she has to like deal with everything all the time. She's always in control and always making sure everything's perfect. Mm-hmm. And then when there's this actual crisis, she's like, of course she would just go into autopilot and just be like, I'll just deal with this.
Yeah, totally. I also read another quote about the birthday party. That's how this short portrays the way that parents inexplicably and despite themselves traumatize their children.
Oh, Absolutely.
Yeah, because obviously Mary is trying her best, but can't ask for help.
She's doing her best. But she's doing her best. You know, sometimes you have to, your kids are just going to see how things really are.
Yeah.
Really sucks.
Yeah. What did you think of Don't Fall?
Don't Fall. Again, I was kind of comparing it to my initial impressions. My notes go as follows. Yeah, and they're very all over the place. So. Mm-hmm. White dreads must die.
Oh my gosh.
And I feel
absolutely.
That. Yeah. I feel like Roxanne Benjamin was like, who is like the most annoying type of character that we can put in this situation? And clearly just like the white guy with dreads who's like kind of a stoner, spiritual stoner type who's like, oh, God.
Yeah. The loud guy with white dreads is always the villain.
Oh, yeah. The villain, or he needs to immediately be dispatched, or both. Mm-hmm. It's funny, this segment I really enjoyed it. Like, I find it very satisfying, but mm-hmm. It's funny, of all of them, there's not much to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot to say about it just because it just kind of seems like the director Roxanne Benjamin, she just wanted to make a monster movie mm-hmm. that had a female monster, and mm-hmm. she did a really good job. And it was super awesome and well done. And to be honest, I found it like, you know, it's like scary, and mm-hmm. your parts I thought were really effective. And I think she's a really good director, but it's, and it's not that I don't think there's nothing else there. There's just, I don't have anything else. Like, it didn't draw anything else from me.
Mm-hmm.
I did make note that like, this is an instance where, and I can't really like fault the director for doing this, because literally every movie does this all the time, especially in horror, but like the reliance on sort of a vague Native American mythology that's nebulous that ends up being the kind of the catalyzing force in this movie. Again, like, yeah, it's just like, it's kind of frustrating to see it, but it happens so often that I don't want to like villainize the director for doing that, because you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of, that was my takeaway from it, watching it the second time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I just didn't really care about any of the characters.
Yeah.
Because we have white dreads, we have guy with glasses, we have nervous, annoying girl, and then girl with brown hair.
Yeah, blonde girl and a brown hair.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I thought the gore was really cool. There was that one shot when White Dreads gets thrown through the window by the monster, which is really sweet.
It's almost like, it looked great. And yeah, there were some nice touches. Like, I loved how the demon, when there's the shot where she's like kind of in the window going after the glasses guy. Mm-hmm. And I just loved how she moved her hands like she was, it's just like her going like
yeah, and she's so fast,
she's like chaos and destruction, which I found it very like, I'm like, that's probably how that would go. Very believable. It almost felt like it was like Roxanne Benjamin was like looking at her sizzle reel, you know, and she was like, well, I don't have any like cool monster like scary shit, so why don't I like do this short and just like, you know, show what I can do in this particular style of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really well done, but I feel like there's maybe not a lot below the surface to pick apart beyond that.
I totally agree. So we can move on to the last short. What did you think of Her Only Living Son?
This one, I remember when I saw it in the theater, I was, I think my expectations were very high because I was like Karen Kusama.
Yeah.
Like, I love everything she's done. And I found, it's not that I didn't think the themes were resonant, because they were. And like on paper, it's a really interesting idea. Like, if Mia Farrow from Rosemary's Baby took her baby and raised it, you know, and went on the lamb, but was insistent on, you you know, raising this baby as her son.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. Yeah, it just kind of left me. I was kind of like, oh, okay. It didn't quite. I'm not sure what it was. Maybe it was the reveal, just something about the reveal of him being like a satanic, you know, the son of Satan or a devil's progeny kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why it didn't quite resonate with me.
Hmm.
But yeah, I do think the idea is really, really interesting. I liked what she tried to do with it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it felt kind of subtle. Like you weren't immediately shown that this was like basically a spiritual sequel to Rosemary's Baby, which I thought was really cool. It just I liked it. And I liked the actress that played Cora. I thought she did such a great job. It was a very emotional, tense job. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, she was really good. Especially her, here's what I think. I think the monologue at the end frustrated me because there was so much exposition in a short period of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know it's a short, so it's hard to show all the things. But mm-hmm. I did find, and she did a good job of delivering it. She killed it. But she, mm-hmm. I think it was because she was you know, I took you out here and we've been hiding out for a long time. And, and she was just kind of explaining why mm-hmm. they were there. I think I was
giving too much away.
But I thought it was interesting too. And again, this is something I just noticed the second time around, but when he, I think maybe you mentioned this later too, so I don't want to jump ahead, but when she's talking to the principal and he's literally pulled a student's fingernails.
Yeah.
He's a horrible person.
Yeah.
And how the principal and the principal is just kind of there's no response really. It did remind me sort of generally how charismatic white male teens get away with a lot more,
mm-hmm.
even though it's very obvious in hindsight that they are sociopathic. I just think of any sort of true crime narrative where you hear about this boy growing up and he's kind of a piece of shit, but his parents make excuses for him.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's also interesting that she doesn't really know what to do with her maybe psychopathic son or troubled son or whatever, but she's not really getting any support either because everyone around her wants him to be the devil. So yeah, that was hard to watch just because she's so desperate for anything, any kind of support. So yeah, this is another short that deals with motherhood. But I thought it was an interesting take on maternal ambivalence. We kind of see this in The Box as well. So I have a quote here from Psychology Today on maternal ambivalence. So as human culture has developed and changed over the millennia, so too has human parenting. But the passion to raise children correctly has reached an apex over the past 30 years or so that burdens contemporary parents to a disturbing degree. These demands engender ambivalence, the mixture of loving and hating feelings that characterizes all important relationships. Ambivalence arises when there is a conflict between the needs of the parents and those of their children. What kind of mother resents her children? Every kind, but to different degrees. The problem is not the feeling, which is usually temporary, but the fear of speaking out about it and the resulting feelings of self-punishment. So yeah, so this is seen in Her Only Living Son. And because she's so desperate and doesn't know what to do with her son, I think there's a bit of it in The Birthday Party too, in that Mary can't ask for help. Not that she resents her child, but I think it's this going through the motions and keeping up appearances that are really pushing her over the edge and making her really anxious. And then it's seen in The Box as well.
It does seem the stigma of publicly admitting, or not even publicly, but admitting to other people that you're I really resent my children.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for women to say something like that, for moms. It's funny, I see this, this is a kind of a weird tangent, but we're in a pandemic where, I find there's a lot of pressure on women to manage their jobs or leave their jobs altogether to like support children who are at home from school right now. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, I have actually like a few friends now who are mothers who have left their day jobs temporarily because they're like, I cannot do this and raise my child at the same time. Mm-hmm. And like some of them have, I find even for them to admit that this is really hard, it feels like it takes an enormous, like, it's hard for them to even say that, mm-hmm. even though it's very obvious. Like, I think we all know that families are being like really challenged right now, but mm-hmm. for some reason, my friends who are moms, they really struggle with like, yeah, they relate amongst each other and like mm-hmm. with their friends, maybe privately, but there's not a lot of, yeah, I don't know. It seems like there's not a ton of public conversation about mm-hmm. like moms being like, this is infuriating to me. I had like career goals and, you know, we had a plan and now this has all been completely derailed. And it's frustrating that I, you know, my plan has been derailed mm-hmm. and I've had to make this choice. But yeah, it's still so weird that like we can't really have those conversations mm-hmm. or that we are, but they're just happening in, I don't know, in different ways, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Or it's still considered like a women's issue.
Yeah, a women's issue when it's a family issue. It's mm-hmm. it's also the husband's issue. Yeah, it's like everyone, it's also society's issue. Like,
yeah.
You know, women leaving the workforce, that's a problem for society and makes mm-hmm. things worse. And yeah, for sure. It's society's problem.
Yeah.
I'm like listening to myself, I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
Maybe when you're editing the podcast, you can give me the devil voice that
yeah.
has in the
yeah. Oh yeah, I wanted to ask you, how did you read the ending of that segment? Because I was reading and like a lot of reviews and synopses saw them as like both dying at the same time. Whereas like, I thought she killed him.
I thought he was killing her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, they both died. Yeah, I did read it as they both just died somehow. Yeah, but that was just my initial reaction. Like, mm-hmm. I may need to watch the scene again.
Yeah, because I initially read it as her killing him.
What gave you that impression from the scene?
Just the way that his body was reacting and like the blood and everything.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to rewatch it. Or maybe it's up for interpretation. Like maybe there's no answers like most of the shorts in this anthology.
How did you feel? How did XX compare to the other anthologies that you watched mm-hmm. this month? Because I listened to your VHS one, but mm-hmm. I haven't heard like, how did you feel it compared to like Three Extremes or like Creepshow?
It kind of reminded me in a way of VHS, unfortunately, not in like the broiness, maybe because it felt like a response to VHS, because VHS is like such a bro-y hellscape. I mean, I thought the animated interstitials are really cool, but I kind of wish that the stories had been tied together a bit more, because 3 out of the 4 shorts deal with motherhood. So I'm not sure if that is intentional or like, I don't know. That seems kind of odd to me for a collection of short films, for 3 of them to sort of have similar themes. What do you think?
Yeah, and that the movie doesn't really acknowledge the similarities. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about the importance of interstitial content too. I kind mm-hmm. of, it's kind of an afterthought with me,
mm-hmm.
except with, I don't know if you've ever seen Tales from the Dark Side.
No.
The interstitial, this is not a spoiler. I'm sure you would really like it, but Debbie Harry is in the interstitial narrative, and it's a really good little mini story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always like remembered that, and it also deals actually with motherhood in its own way. But yeah, it is funny now that you mention it that there's nothing really strong that like ties
mm-hmm.
all the segments together. There's just kind of this. The interstitial with XX had a real music video vibe to me, which mm-hmm. is maybe, and I don't know who shot that, but I don't know if that was kind of the point of that, but It looked pretty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my only note about this. But I really enjoyed it. I think there should be more projects like this.
Yes.
Jason Blum, get a life. So yeah, so that's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks so much, Allison, for coming on the show again. So great to talk to you about movies.
Thank you for having me. And thanks for all the tangents.
Yeah.
I loved it.
No, they're necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Especially with a topic like this, there's so much that is deeply irritating.
Yeah.
whenever you get into a debate about, like, especially what men think about women making horror, it's so, like, it's the eternal, like, frustration.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Where can people find you? Find your work and your zines?
You can go to my website, which is badly in need of updating, but it's womenandsongs666.com. Very professional. And yeah, you can find a bunch of stuff on there. And then I am also on Instagram at womenandsongs. Wait, no, that's not my Instagram name. It's the Gabba Gabba Goo. I need to change my Instagram. But as a Sopranos fan,
yeah,
you understand.
Yeah, I get it.
Sopranos themed Instagram handle for a while.
Yeah.
Like a rite of passage.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, just to another reminder, CQW's Fund Drive starts on Friday, February 5th. If you can, please consider donating at fundrive.cqw.ca. And you can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. And you can find me Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. It's all Bikini Drive-In. All right. Thanks. Bye.
25% of our annual budget comes from listeners like you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting CKUW 95.9 FM at Fundrive.